Thank you very much for the invitation. It's been fun to be here, as usual. So I'm going to talk about mostly about a recent paper with Victor Gobenko and Gonzalo Taroba about the connection between de Sitter holography and the TT bar deformation, or a generalization of it, but also, time permitting, relate it to a recent paper with Shi and Gonzalo on the entanglement entropy portion of the title. I'll start with a review of this whole development, which goes back over a decade with a few of the earlier papers listed here for completeness, because, you know, certainly not everybody is working on this or that familiar with it. So, but the main goal will be to get to these new results. So the outline is here. I'll start with a brief but general introduction and motivation, and then turn to these more recent results. Okay, so accelerated expansion is true. It was a big deal 20 years ago when this was discovered by multiple measurements in the universe agreeing on the discovery of this new parameter that's tiny in units of any other scales in physics that we know, but very much there. And also in the early universe, there's a lot of evidence for primordial inflation, you know, the simplest versions of which fit this curve beautifully of CMB measurements. And so, you know, the observational statement is quite clear that accelerated expansion dominates in our cosmology physically. In effective field theory, this perhaps shouldn't surprise us. It's, you know, the most relevant term in the Lagrangian. And even though it's just one number, this discovery 20 years ago, it has an enormous impact. There are some single numbers that do that. Of course, here it changes the causal structure of space-time. So here's the cartoon picture of that, where observers are drawn apart and end up outside of each other's light cone. And here is the Penrose diagram of de Sitter showing the light rays that go at 45 degrees, as it always in a Penrose diagram, a particular observer on the right in this picture. So each point, aside from the left and right sides of this Penrose diagram, each point represents a circle, which has vanished on the two sides. And this also shows the causal structure, these horizons, these observer-dependent horizons. Okay, so that, of course, is a big change from zero or negative cosmological constant. It can get a little philosophical. Not everyone can collect, not any one observer can collect all the data. And there's a very interesting and observationally motivated question of how you formulate physics given that. It's fun to work on. It involves everything that we deal with in high energy and gravity theory. And again, it's very much grounded in real observations as well. Okay, so what about string theory? So in string theory, you have to turn, so it's a very immediate statement that almost all the sources of potential energy that we have in reducing string theory to four dimensions are positive. So that includes the leading term in the potential energy classically that arises in almost every dimensionality. And if for any dimension, including the special case of 10, most choices of the internal dimensions would have negative curvature, and then when you reduce that, that's positive potential energy. Fluxes are positive, these generalized electromagnetic fields that we deal with. And so, you know, you have to turn off almost everything off to get either the anti-de Sitter type solutions that we work a lot with in the theory, or Minkowski solutions with a lot of extended supersymmetry. Those are extremely special. Almost everything is positive potential energy with this rich landscape that, of course, is quite complicated. There are sources of negative potential energy that appear as they, as indicated in this picture. For example, if we expand our potential energy, or we look at our potential energy as a function of simple scalar fields descending from the higher dimensions of string theory, such as the overall volume of the extra dimensions, the string coupling, and so on. One very basic constraint that's been known forever on the landscape is that the potential goes to zero when those variables get very weak. So when the curvature gets weak, when the string coupling gets weak, the potential goes to zero either from below, as in ADS solutions, or from above, as in these more complicated metastable de Sitter scenarios. So that's a basic and very, you know, kind of pedestrian constraint. I'm stressing it here, even though it's old news and probably well known to you guys, because it will play a role later in this question of that we're coming to of uplifting the ADS-CFT duality to cosmology. That feature will enter. Okay, so, but at this very gross level, of course, the main reason to be interested in accelerated expansion of the universe is because it's true, because it's been observed. But then when it comes to our best candidate for quantum gravity, most of what that does is at least positive potential energy and, by the way, also very little supersymmetry generically. So those observed features at least fit with the most generic behavior of string theory as well. And of course, many of us worked a lot on developing de Sitter constructions in string theory, including some of the ones listed here. One that'll come up that we did with Sheehan and Gonzalo and others will play a role in this discussion today. Again, I want to stress that in string theory, we believe, quite good arguments for de Sitter metastable solutions, but there is no such thing as just writing down a hard cosmological constant, and that will, as I keep saying, that will play a role. Okay, so let me finish this kind of general list of motivations and background on de Sitter by reminding us of the Gibbons-Hawking entropy, which is another kind of low-energy macroscopic analysis going back to the 70s, where they had arguments sort of like those for black holes, that the area of the observer horizon should behave like an entropy. And like with black holes, we'd like to understand what that means, how to formulate that entropy microphysically. Okay. So let me just summarize that motivation this way. If we consider the ADS case, which is a very interesting case in itself, we turn almost everything off, but then we get these beautiful, simple solutions. And in that case, we know the basic statement of the framework for those, even though there's a lot of ongoing work to understand the details much better. The observables being the CFT ones. In Minkowski space, we have an S matrix, and DS, we need to fill that in. Okay. So I'm going to build up to this starting from, in fact, the traditional way of thinking about ADS-CFT due to Maldacena, where we start with a bunch of three brains or some configuration of D brains, and we look at its low energy limit in two different ways. This is the so-called brain construction that led to ADS-CFT originally, and it proceeds, again, by starting with a bunch of brains, which in general we can put at the tip of a cone with a Einstein base. And again, look at its low energy limit in two ways. One way gives us the low energy quantum field theory built up by these open strings. And the other way gives us the highly redshifted core of the solution. And that turns into ADS5 times S5, where, you know, the number of D3 brains, the color number, becomes NC flux quanta. So the reason I'm belaboring this, which I know is quite well known, is that one of the first steps we'll take is to start from such a system, and actually the D1, D5 brain version of it, and add ingredients to get de Sitter and see what happens to this. So that's the next step. So first I'll just state the conjecture, which we'll see two and in some sense a third argument for it that are independent, which is that DS in D plus one dimensions can be formulated holographically as equivalent to two coupled cutoff theories constrained by D-dimensional gravity. And we'll actually, by the end of this talk, we will actually get a sharper statement of the formulation of each of these two matter sectors. But I'll build up to that and start from the original conjecture. So the macroscopic idea that led to this with Andreas Karch, David Tong, Mohsen Ali Shahia was simply this, that the a patch of De Sitter can be seen to be a warped compactification down to the lower dimensional De Sitter space with two warped throats, two low energy regions, two regions with very strong redshift. So I've depicted this on the Penrose diagram beside a picture of the ADS Penrose diagram with a similar foliation in terms of De Sitter slices. And if you, for example, look at the very low energy region of this, it agrees at leading order with the low energy region on each of the two sides of this picture that I've drawn. So the metric is written up here. The warp factor is sine or sinh in the two cases. And this gives this first statement that I explained, that De Sitter has low energy regions, two of them, that behave just like the low energy regions of ADS or of a CFT living on De Sitter space. And by low energy, we mean below some radial cutoff. So just to anticipate a bit, there's some, in my view, rather big news in holography recently, which is that people have understood a very exciting and viable proposal and well-motivated proposal for what that means, for what a radial cutoff means in the dual description. So we're going to be making use of that.
Yeah. Let me ask a question. Is of course true that there's disagreement at first that we're going to consider an ADS space in this way. At the same level, you could also study Minkowski space.
Mm-hmm.
Is there an interesting story about that as well?
There could be. That's a very, very special case, so I actually don't focus on it, but there could be.
But it's just, I mean, you say these two are the same, it's just the intermediate
case. It absolutely is the intermediate case. I think it's interesting to consider, you know, as you know, we're going to use TT-bar, and I think that question is interesting.
Yeah,
I agree. But it is intermediate, it is special, and the real case is DS, so I'm happy, that's why I'm, you know, focused on it, but I like that question. So continuing with the background, just because I want to be extremely clear, the reason I take this as seriously as I do, or at least already took it as seriously as I have, is the fact that we get the same statement in a completely different way, and in a way that uses this weird limitation of string theory, this metastability. So let me try and explain that on this slide. So the idea here is to take the, as I anticipated earlier, to take the brain construction of ADS and see what happens to it when we add what we need to produce a De Sitter spacetime instead. So the minimal way that that can work, as I mentioned earlier, is that the De Sitter sort of two-term stabilization structure can be uplifted, preserving that it vanishes at you know, the origin there, to a three-term structure, meaning the contribution to the potential coming from the positive curvature of the Einstein space and the ADS brain construction has to flip sign, and furthermore there has to be another contribution of the opposite sign, which in all the models that have been constructed happens to be played by so-called orientifold planes. So let's just see what this does. So I'm going to belabor the equation for a cone first. So that can be considered a radial Friedman evolution with this equation. Big R is the size of the base of the cone for every little r, proper distance along it. And here's the equation. It's like a radial Friedman equation. So what happens to that when we go to DS is the flip of the sign of the source term from the curvature, flipping sign, and then some other term that has the opposite sign and a higher power of 1 over r. That alone implies that instead of being a cone that goes off forever, in the De Sitter case, the analog of this brain construction, I'm ignoring the flux term in both cases because that is identified with the brains. So the brain construction is the first non-flux bit of it, and it very clearly turns into this thing that starts out expanding and then contracts again. It's like a closed universe in the radial direction. So that happens here from this, you know, in this simple way. But I want to stress again that it, first of all, it's an independent statement. It's not the same as the argument based on the macroscopic redshift, you know, pattern that I mentioned here, the Randall Sundrum type description. It's instead this top-down brain construction statement that leads us to two sectors. And it does so in a way that really came from this constraint in the string landscape that we have this metastable structure. So, you know, I think this is, it's qualitative but very concrete, and this is to me a already too much to be a coincidence. So here, so anyway, here's the picture of what we've said so far in terms of the two cases. Now, let me say quickly what price we pay for gravity that does persist in the lower dimensional description. So suppose we go from 3D to 2D. Well, basically, gravity is a set of constraints, and we can handle that. And it, for example, here I've written the Hamiltonian constraint in a certain way of organizing the 2D gravity in terms of a Liouville field. And what you see is you have some matter theory that in our situation has these two matter sectors which will interact. And, you know, then by the way, they're constrained by gravity. That gives you the de Sitter expansion, the lower dimensional theory, in a way that, you know, people played with in the past, just out of interest in coupling matter to gravity and looking at the dynamics of that. So what I'm trying to get at here is that it is tractable to deal with the residual gravity, at least once we're down in low enough dimension. Now there's a third indication of this structure of the two matter sectors interacting through gravity, which is the so-called DSCFT conjecture, which is quite different physically and conceptually. It attempts to make sense of the future boundary of de Sitter. It ignores the decays, although for us, again, that entered into the second independent argument. But anyway, it's formulated on a future spatial-like slice. But and the original idea that Schrödinger had was that it would be more or less some analytic continuation of ADS-CFT with the partition function of a CFT giving the wave functional of the dual gravity theory. And that's fine, but then if you go to compute anything, you end up doing an isomorphic problem to the one that we were led to earlier, in the sense that, say, you wanted to compute some expectation value of some operator, you would, you know, integrate over the argument, the metric on that space-like slice, g mu nu, psi dagger o psi. So you have two of these CFT partition functions, two identical CFTs, and you're integrating over the metric, so in effect you're doing lower dimensional gravity once again. Okay, so that is what I meant by 2+1 arguments for this same statement about the two matter sectors which are coupled through gravity. Okay, so but the rest of the talk will be about the new results that we've been developing that sharpen this quite a bit and allow us to make statements about the entropy. But before I get there, let me just list a couple of also old calculations we did with in those early papers that included observables like transmission of waves across the two throats, and also a fun exercise that we did with, again, with Shi and Gonzalo and Bart Horn, showing that the holographic Wilsonian RG, so to speak, where you integrate out parts of the space-time down to some radial scale and work out the effective action for that, that it's equally constrained for the DSDS and the ADSDS theories, basically because you stabilize the moduli in both cases. So if you think about where non-trivial RG flows come from in gauge gravity duality, it's coming from some scalar field that evolves radially. But if you've instead stabilized or metastabilized it, it doesn't do that, and you have, in the ADS case, you have a CFT with no flow, and in the DS case, again, the single trace couplings didn't flow, and the multi-trace ones were determined by lower trace ones. So it was a highly constrained RG, but still, it hasn't been clear, what this is in its full glory. Clearly, they agree in the infrared, and they would agree in flat space in the infrared too. But there's a distinct behavior as you go to higher redshift and more toward the ultraviolet. And so it wasn't clear, even though we learned that it's a highly constrained dual theory, that didn't tell us what it is and how to, formulate it concretely. But now here's a summary of what we can used to do that, and it starts from a development that's completely independent of this and very interesting in itself. It's been going on for as long, actually, this TT bar deformation. So, and it's proposed holographic interpretation. So I'm going to go through that and how we generalize it to de Sitter in the probably what remains of the talk, given time. As I mentioned, we also can use that to determine the interpretation of the Gibbons Hawking entropy in this framework. So this TT bar deformation is started life as a very particular way of going on a trajectory in the space of quantum field theories that involve an irrelevant operator that is specified at each step in this trajectory as a certain quadratic combination of the stress tensor at the previous step. So I'll say what it is shortly, quite specifically, but the way it's prescribed is not the same as just adding some irrelevant operator with a large coefficient and trying to deal with the consequences. It's distinct from that and more tractable for certain calculations. And please.
Can I ask you a question?
Please.
I didn't quite understand. What did you say about these signals that you can receive from behind?
What did I? So, I was saying we did some calculations in the past. So, you can play with the system and consider things like a state which includes a wave coming up this way, and you can work out the transmission and reflection, and what this was the transmission coefficient, that's all.
Sorry?
It's a transmission coefficient of waves from one side to the other. That's what that was.
You've traced over.
Well, we'll get there. Well, that will be our interpretation of the entropy, but we have not said that here. I'm just here. This is just a couple of early calculations that we did on this system. That's all. We can come back to your question if you want shortly, but okay. So this TT bar deformation started in 2004, and then in 2016 was kind of completed to a beautiful set of calculations along this irrelevant trajectory. So the basic version of that involves a two-dimensional theory on a flat space-time where it's defined as a differential equation where this TT bar really means the combination of quadratic combination, basically the determinant of the stress energy tensor T. And in the papers by Zamolodchikov and his collaborators, he showed that this particular combination of stress energy tensor components factorizes for any theory on a flat two-dimensional space-time. And that factorization allows one to work with this operator much more easily than you could with a generic irrelevant deformation. So that's one aspect of it. That factorization is something that we can get a bit more for free if we work in large n approximations and in other situations with more curvature or in higher dimensions. And but the other thing about it, again, is how it's specified. Again, it's a differential relation, so you start with some seed theory, you add this TT bar to it, where T is its original stress energy tensor, but then you recompute the stress tensor, add TT bar again, and so on. Let me just jump to the kind of result that you could get from this. For simplicity in this talk, I'll just work at zero spatial momentum, although you can easily fold that in. Let's use the fact that we have just in this vanilla version, we have just the one dimensionful coupling lambda, which has dimensions of length squared, and identify the deformation with the statement that trace T is given by this TT bar operator. Trace T, of course, is, you know, generates dilatations, but everything in this theory depends on the ratio of this coupling lambda and the size of the cylinder, so it's the same thing. Given that, we have one algebraic relation for the two components of the stress energy tensor at zero momentum. Let's use that. So that's this formula here. Then the spatial stress energy tensor component being pressure gives us another equation, a differential equation. And you can easily determine that the solution to that with the right boundary condition that they agree at lambda equals zero is this so-called Drest energy level formula. So it's a, you know, simple but fully non-perturbatively resummed expression for the expectation value of these energy levels all along this non-trivial trajectory. So there's been a lot of work on this and related things. Dubofsky has been involved from early stages with his collaborators, including our collaborator, Viktor Gobenko. And those guys showed and worked with the there's a relationship between this. You get the same dressing if you couple the same seed theory to so-called two-dimensional JT gravity. So that's another interesting statement in this field. And the simplest example of this whole thing is something very familiar, which is the Nambu-Goto theory on an extended string. So that's the dressed action in that case. But the point here is it's very powerful in the sense that you can determine these answers for any seed theory. It can be a highly non-trivial interacting seed theory. It can be a holographic theory with a holographic dual, and so on. And these statements apply.
Can you say what the interpretation is if lambda is negative and you get into complex just energy lambda?
Well, we'll get there. Well, actually, it's lambda positive. So T, it's lambda, this component of the stress tensor is minus the energy density. So yeah, it's lambda positive for which this becomes complex. And that is the case that will interest us shortly. So I'll speak to what the utility of that is shortly. In fact, here it is. So, right. So what she is getting at is the case that's familiar from world sheet string theory is the case with this lambda negative, and that's the usual Nambu-Goto theory with the usual properties. Causality properties in the target space. The case we'll actually be more interested in is the other case, because this Drest energy formula having a scale at which the energies, the real energies end, which is what she was just noting, is that, again, this being negative minus the energy, if it's too big, this goes complex. And what Herman Valinda and his collaborators noticed is that cutoff on the real energy spectrum and just generally this square root formula for the Drest energies agrees exactly with the energy spectrum where energy is defined by the Brown-York stress tensor in general relativity, the so-called quasi-local stress energy tensor, that its energy levels, if you put a radial cutoff on ADS and consider, not just the vacuum, but excited states, particles, and black holes, that this quasi-local stress sensor, which is a general relativistic notion of energy, agrees precisely with that square root dressed energy formula of Zolotnikov. So they're using the thing I mentioned earlier, that factorization applies at large n, even, you know, beyond, well, sorry, they don't need that here, I'm sorry. What I'm getting at right now is that we can anticipate generalizing this to other situations. In their case, they considered this cylinder boundary, which is already quite interesting. So, you know, this proposal has a lot going for it. Here's the square root formula and some variables for the energy spectrum according to the, you know, general relativity side, which again, if you map the variables correctly, it reproduces that dressed energy formula that I showed earlier. Now, to anticipate slightly what I want to note here is that, again, in these kind of theories where there is a large N, you know, holographic interpretation in the seed theory, there's factorization for that reason. And so we can imagine generalizing the story using that rather than needing the more elegant Zolotnikov argument for the factorization. But let's get there step by step. So this is a really interesting proposal in itself. There's, again, in my view, too much going for it to be a coincidence, but there's a lot of subtleties that we want to understand better. In GR, this Dirichlet problem is not generally well posed, although actually the de Sitter case will have better properties in that regard. It's a bit of an irony. And one needs to make sure that one can cut off. So far, I've discussed everything in terms of the stress energy tensor, which is universal and related to the pure gravity sector of the gravity side. And, you know, we have to make sure that one can formulate the system with all fields cut off. So in any complete model, there's a lot more than the pure gravity sector. And there's already some work on this by Hartman and Edgar Shkulian and company. We're pursuing this as well, trying to fill in a lot more of it with Dan Friedman and company. And the upshot is it's a relatively simple addition. So I'll mention that later. But I think you can maybe start to see the plan for the generalization that we're interested in. Remember, in our situation, we are interested in this finite region. You know, de Sitter only has a finite region at finite times, and we're interested in building up this bulk geometry as opposed to the bulk geometry of ADS, but making use of the fact that they match in this low energy regime. And since there's now a, you know, very reasonable proposal for what a radial cutoff means, we can proceed as follows. We can equally well work out the behavior of this quasi-local stress tensor for a de Sitter bulk cutoff at some radial scale, and for the ADS case with a curved boundary instead of a flat boundary. And so we do that, and we get, you know, results for this quasi-local stress tensor, and things like the equation for the trace of T, which in the vanilla case had this one term, lambda TT bar. Now it has two additional terms. So this is so far working on the gravity side. We learn that if there's a generalization of TT bar, which formulates not a finite patch of ADS, but a finite patch of DS, well, it better generate these two terms as well as the first one. But we're allowed to specify it in the same way that Zolotnikov had specified his trajectory. We're allowed to say it as a differential relation. And, you know, as we'll see, that makes all the difference. Now, there are two terms here. One of them is a constant, and the other one is this curvature term. The curvature term shouldn't surprise you at the first step of the trajectory, because, let's say we just add this curvature term, turn this one off. and work at the beginning of the trajectory, well, this is just the trace anomaly. However, it's predicting that the trace anomaly looks the same at all the steps, and that wasn't obvious to us or really to others in the field, although some authors, without adding the third term, had considered the system with a curved boundary and had essentially tried to take this as the defining equation of the deformation. One of the things we have done is to not make that assumption, but reproduce the results of that equation, so kind of retroactively justifying that. But I think it's an interesting point in itself, how it happens that the anomaly is so simple all along this non-trivial flow.
So in the ADS case, is the deformed theory well-defined non-perturbatively in lambda, or is it only, should we think of it as perturbatively defined in lambda?
Oh, I don't think it's just perturbative. I mean, these formulas are, turn off the curvature now if you want, or, you know, these formulas are good, are resummed in lambda. And again, the, you know, the nice simple case of the, it's actually not just the free Nambu-Goto theory, but various sigma models and so on that you know, one can resum at the level of the action as well. It's not, certainly not just a perturbative expansion.
So in that case, lambda is negative, so...
That doesn't... Well,
do you think it, there could be such an explanation for positive lambda as well?
Well, it's the calculations that have been done in this regard look similar, right? They are non-perturbative. I mean, I agree with you that the Nambu-Goto theory is usually... There's actually a paper by Dubofsky that addresses the other case and claims that it's equally good as a... As the Nambu-Goto theory with the normal sign, because of the special features of two dimensions where you actually don't get causality issues and so on. But yeah, it's the calculations that have been done are these non-trivial ones, and those are not just perturbative in lambda. So yeah, I don't know. The S matrix calculations also work for in terms of the JT dressing. Giving the same answers, those also work for either sign. So we could talk more about it, but it's, yeah, I think it's clear that it goes beyond perturbation theory lambda for sure. What is true is that it's not a local theory in the end. At least most people view it that way. Partly because of this particular example where it's a string theory in the end, a world sheet string theory, which is gravitational. So not all local correlation functions should make sense. There's a paper by Flauger, Dubofsky, and Garbenko that, you know, spells this out pretty carefully. So there, you know, there remain subtle issues with the whole thing, but I don't think it's just a perturbative statement in lambda for sure.
Uh-huh. Your previous equation, P at some point of lambda was expressed in terms of P at zero. And now it has disappeared.
Yeah, so let's go, I haven't explained this formula yet. So let's consider what effect this trace flow equation would have, and let's actually view it as an algebraic equation like we did before. Okay, but then also use the pressure, the fact that the spatial component is pressure. And the general solution to that is this formula. Now, so you can consider, if you like, first the case where this eta is plus one, that's the bulk ADS case. And then one would anticipate that excited energy levels appear here, and there would be a similar it is similar to the previous formula. It certainly reduces to it if we turn everything else off. It goes back to that. Now, what we're going to do is actually start from that case, work our way all the way in, keeping everything, not throwing out any of the complex levels, and then go back out with another contribution that generates the de Sitter version, which in that part of the trajectory flips the sign here. And the whole thing stays real throughout that, but I'll get there shortly. Here I'll just add one more comment about the bulk matter. If we have some scalar, for example, it's easy to see what happens to this trace flow equation. For that case, there's some double trace contribution to it. And you know, in that sense, it's part of the same sort of story. It's a similar generalization. But for the rest of this talk, I'll focus on the constant contribution that we find just from pure gravity, but in de Sitter bulk. Okay. When it comes to excited levels in the de Sitter case, which David was just asking about, we'll use a kind of simplification of 3D gravity, which is just that these all only, they basically all just source deficit angles. So there's an old paper of Dzer and Jakub that spells this out. We'll play with a kind of simple tower of these states. And the in all those states, the stress energy has this square root form on the gravity side. Okay, and there's a little footnote here that, you know, is spelled out in our paper, which is the irony I mentioned earlier, which is that there are some strange features of the Dirichlet problem. In particular, for example, Don, who left, and Mukund Rangamani found superluminal propagation of so-called boundary gravitons. And this actually agrees with a similar pathology of the TT bar with the holographic sign of the coupling lambda. Interestingly, that doesn't happen in the de Sitter for the de Sitter boundary. The de Sitter boundary is also better behaved as a for perturbation theory, so the propagator doesn't have too many zeros and all that. So it's there are other situations where it actually simplifies the math to have de Sitter, and this is actually one of those things. But yeah, please.
What was the meaning of that data?
Oh, did I not? Okay. Sorry, I should have pointed that earlier. I said it later in the square root formula. Let me start from the action in the 3D theory, right? That's where we got this quasi-local stress energy tensor. And I was saying we get that for either sign of the cosmological constant in the bulk. That our notation for that is this eta. So eta equals plus one is the bulk ADS, negative cosmological constant. The eta equals minus one is de Sitter. So this term vanishes for the ADS case, and it's going to be turned on in the de Sitter case. Okay. So by now it probably won't surprise you that the answer for how to generalize the TT bar trajectory is to add this constant piece at each step. And I'll show you the derivation of that shortly. But basically what it says is that at each step we add not just TT bar, but also a two-dimensional cosmological term. Now, normally if you just took a field theory and added a cosmological constant, it wouldn't do anything or do much. But remember that at each step we recompute the stress sensor, and now the cosmological constant is in there, so it gets in there non-linearly, and we'll see that in the formulas. In fact, you see it here. So this eta inside the square root, you can think of it as 1 plus eta minus 1, so it's 1 plus this lambda 2, this two-dimensional cosmological constant term, and it's, you know, it's in the non-linear part of the story. It's inside that square root. Okay, so here's the detailed prescription. It's a clear generalization of Zamolodnikov's differential equation. We start from the log of the partition function and define the trajectory by this d by d lambda of log z is tt bar plus this cosmological term. If we, for simplicity, consider these vacuum states or these deficit angle states, then there's a simple algebraic relation between the two components of the stress energy tensor. We also have this separate statement that trace T generates dilatations. And now taking an extra derivative of the top equation, plugging that in gives a differential equation for the energies, which now has a single extra term that comes from this two-dimensional cosmological constant in the de Sitter case. I want to note here that we don't assume this trace flow equation with its simple anomaly contribution. That is a output of what we do, meaning that this equation has the solution that I've written here agreeing with the one we derived on the gravity side from, you know, the Einstein equations, which included that trace equation that did have the simple two-dimensional curvature contribution to it. But we didn't assume that here, so this retroactively justifies what people had done with that before, treating it as a definition. In any case, the point here is there's a simple and, you know, apparently natural generalization of TT bar, which is TT bar plus a two-dimensional cosmological term at each step of the trajectory, which builds up the dressed energies of a finite region of the de Sitter spacetime bulk. So we can ground de Sitter holography in a full-fledged CFT, start with just that, then take a trajectory which includes the curvature contribution, but not anything more, to bring in the boundary as a DS boundary of ADS, and then go to where they agree, treat that as the initial condition of a new piece of this trajectory in which we now turn on at each step this cosmological term. And that builds up for us the warp throat of the DSDS duality. Okay, so this is the basic scheme, and it really fills a big gap that we had had. We had not known how to, you know, completely specify the two sides or the each side of this DSDS theory. That is, we knew it had these two matter sectors. We knew the energy level at which it gets cut off. We knew a lot about it. We had a nice result about the entropy and the interpretation of the entropy. But now, you know, given the proposal, which we're assuming here is going to hold up, of how to interpret the TT bar deformation in terms of a radial cutoff, we can readily generalize that to the de Sitter bulk instead of the ADS bulk with, you know, this 2DCC at each step. And so now there's a lot to do to, you know, test this further and apply it to other things like the obvious joining of the two of these two throats and so on. So I'll save as much more as we can fit in about that next. But she.
Sorry. So you mentioned a while ago that in this, maybe in this flow, we need to keep the complex levels. Can you say more about what happened to them at the end?
Yeah, let's discuss that. It's one of the many interesting subtleties with TT bar in general. And we can discuss that in both cases. So we bring in the boundary, and formally some of those original energy levels are now complex. If we're going to stop there, we can get a consistent theory at least. We can at least get a consistent theory by simply throwing away the complex levels, and then we have, you know, a finite dimensional Hilbert space up to that level. When I say I want to keep them until the very end, what I mean is, suppose in the ADS case you want to bring in the boundary, you bring it in very far, but then you change your mind and you want to go back out and stop somewhere else. You better have kept all the level. You know, you would have, if you threw out all the levels when you were had brought the boundary in too far, then you would have lost them and you would not have them anymore when you went back out. So all I'm saying is, in both cases, do whatever trajectory you're going to do, and then at the end, you'll have some levels that don't fit, and, you know, probably the right way to treat those is to truncate them. Even that is maybe not totally clear. It's something under discussion in the whole, you know, the TT bar field. There are calculations of things like partition functions and, you know, with nice properties that keep those levels, so what happens when you throw them away is an interesting question. But all I'm saying at this point is well, two things, the level at which they go complex and the fact that that agrees beautifully with the radial cutoff is, you know, I think a big selling point for Verlinde et al.'s proposal. And in that context, it seems that you would basically throw them away. But I'm saying you don't do that until you get to where you're stopping, because otherwise, you know, you would lose them if you went back and forth. Or in our case, we don't go back and forth so much, but we go way in and then we come out in a different way, so we better not lose them in either case. Okay, so, please.
On the Valcarcel states, states with a naked singularity, the ones that are above the threshold when they become complex.
Do they have a naked singularity?
Is it when the size of the would-be horizon is outside of the boundary of the space-time?
Oh, okay. Maybe you could. I'm not really sure what physical interpretation to give them, because I mean, there's more going on. Their energy being complex means it's not a real solution to begin with, I think.
Well, right? Yeah. The point of view of the, because if you do the calculation in the bulk, is the size of, if the mass is the size of a black hole, is when the size becomes of the equal to the cutoff.
Yeah, it is basically that. Okay. Right. That's the right intuition, but formally, if you just keep going with the solution, then something like what you're saying is happening, but I'm not sure how to think about it really as a GR solution anymore. What I'm doing is keeping it formally until the end and then throwing that away. So, I want to make sure I'm addressing what you're actually asking. So.
I think that's fine. I mean, it's not this, even if there is a negative singularity, it's not how to think about them. I don't know. Should you? No, but what I was thinking was just to do a naive continuation of the mass in that formula beyond when the horizon disappears from the shield.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then you're saying, okay, doesn't that mean you're inside and you're seeing the singularity? I should be able to give you a better answer than this, but those words alone don't indicate to me that it's a naked singularity, because at least the singularity inside a black hole is, of course, a space-like singularity. So it might not be that dramatic, but it's also not real. So it's even more challenging, perhaps, than just a singularity. I don't know.
If you have the alien boundary, then it might make sense that the wrong sign is peculiar. But as far as I understand, in your picture, the wrong sign is lambda.
Mm-hmm.
In your picture, in the end, you have a patch of GS, and the location of the boundary is pretty arbitrary, so you should be able to move in both directions. So you need both signs of lambda, right?
What you might need is both signs of the square root branch. The sign of lambda, let's go slowly on this because I want to know what you're saying in case I'm missing some possibility, but at least the way we've formulated it, which reproduces the de Sitter case quasi-local stress sensor, the sign of lambda is always the same. Maybe we don't have to use judgmental right-wrong language, but it's the holographic sign, whatever. It's the same one that Hermann had. But the de Sitter boundary makes it actually not superluminal, for one thing, so it's not, it's more, perhaps less concerning already to have that sign. And then we don't actually change that sign when we go back out in the de Sitter direction. Instead, what we're doing is we're adding, this term at each step, but with the same sign of TT bar coupling lambda. Perhaps there's some other way to organize it that gives the same answer. Is that what you're saying?
What I'm saying is, so I think what gives intuition is that we sometimes hear that one of the two signs corresponds to moving the boundary outwards. outside the ADS.
Has that been established? I mean, I know there's an idea.
Some intuitive sense people say this works.
They just try and say that, yeah.
In the case of ADS, that sounds peculiar. And but in the case where you're moving the boundary inside the S, you want to be able to do that.
Well, it's interesting because I want to talk to you more about that later, perhaps. But so far we've stopped at this middle slice, and I agree with you. You could ask about moving further, and certainly in GR you could go further. You could instead of just doing this slice, you could go even further, right? And you could work out this quasi-local stress energy tensor just as well. What that matches to at the level of these stress energy formulas is when this is minus one, the most UV slice corresponds to where this cancels out and the square root vanishes. You know, it's just the extrinsic curvature is vanishing there. To go further, you know, you can then keep going formally, at least, and flip the sign of the square root, take the opposite branch. That's what would formally give this quasi-local stress sensor for the larger region going further. Now, I don't know if that makes sense in the 2D theory entirely. I don't know. But just to be clear, at least, about what we have done, what we have formulated, we did keep the holographic sign throughout the whole thing. But we do get what you're, I'm glad you asked, because we do see the huge difference in the DS case, that you can only go out to a certain finite UV because that cutoff corresponds precisely to when this is a minus one in that case in our notation, and when the curvature can't get too low, and that you see here. I guess we're more or less out of time. I was going to discuss the entropy results, but basically they follow from this duality, which we can now state as this TT bar trajectory plus lambda 2, for if we can do it for any boundary metric, any boundary conditions, and get really a dictionary between the two descriptions of that system, then we could use the gravity side as usual to compute things like the Renyi entropies. The thing that we had done in a somewhat different way in the paper with Xi recently, where you get a simple answer for that in DSDS. Let me just finish here, because we're basically out of time, by flashing the upshot of that, which is, you can compute these Renyi entropies. Obtain a result, which is the result you would get if you imagine the state is maximally mixed, meaning the Renyi entropies all end up the same up at large C in the large C approximation. And this follows from the usual path integral methods on the gravity side, which relate to a nice RT-like statement about the Renyi entropies as a cosmic brain tension, or area of a cosmic brain locus. And the upshot is the following. For this DSDS system, there's a natural reduced density matrix we can formulate by tracing out half the system. So now we're finally doing that. And that, first of all, is the thing that this observer on the right part of the picture must do. They don't see the other side, so they're the one who should trace out the other side. And we get an answer for the entropy of that reduced density matrix and its Renyi entropies. That is, not surprisingly, the area of the circle or sphere at the middle here. And that those entropies are all the same. So we can, in this framework, we have a definite interpretation of the Gibbons-Hawking entropy, in other words, as the von Neumann entropy of the reduced density matrix tracing out one of the two TT bar plus lambda 2 addressed CFTs. So it has a definite statistical interpretation in this framework. And moreover, it's more beyond the von Neumann entropy, we find this flat entanglement spectrum as well, which is interesting, and says that the two are highly interacting. So it's another of these systems where entanglement corresponds to space-time being knitted together, in this case, the two sides of our DSDS construction. It will decay ultimately. There's, again, a Randall-Sundrum-like framework for that. It'll be interesting to generalize this to higher dimensions, but there are some really interesting subtleties there that one should go slowly on. And the gravity side results look very similar. There's the square root dress formula for the quasi-local stress center in all dimensions. It looks very similar. On the other hand, the field theory situation seems quite different in two dimensions versus higher dimensions. And so it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. So let me stop on time and just leave you with this summary. Thanks.
So you mentioned the TT bar definition in higher dimensions.
Yeah.
What is the definition of the TT bar definition in such cases?
Yeah, well, what people, you know, it's kind of, you have to say more what the meaning of it is, but basically what people like Marika Taylor and Kutov, Shigulian, Hartman, Fujini did is to start from the gravity side, or one way to approach that is, if you have in mind this holographic application, is to start from the gravity side and look at this trace flow equation, the trace T equals stuff, okay? And you can see what it is on the right-hand side of that, and it's a particular quadratic combination of T mu nu again. People have, there have been other proposals to generalize it involving keeping it being the determinant, which is a different statement. So the gravity side in the holographic case looks quite similar in different dimensions. However, it already, you know, has immediate issues on the field theory side, even at the level of this combination. So the combination that you infer in the way I just mentioned. Doesn't have the cancellation of singularities that the 2D version of it has. I think basically it's like there's a Tij minus some coefficient times trace T squared, and the higher dimensional version of that doesn't lead to a cancellation. It's like a 1 over D minus 1 there or something. And so, you know, as usual, there's more components of the stress energy tensor and things are less constrained. But again, the gravity side is suggesting there is something that, you know, on the gravity side situation generalizes looks very similar in all dimensions. And so that's probably a clue. There's probably some special feature of holographic theories that enables the story to continue. At least that would be the optimistic view. But then the challenge is to understand how that works on the field theory side, where there do seem to be these rather dramatic differences between two dimensions and higher dimensions.
Are there any other questions? Okay, if not, let's thank you again.